interesting. The first year of my becoming a Dominican priest is called the novitiate. It is God boot camp. Boot camp for God. We are sent off to a parish in Cincinnati, Ohio for a year and a half, and all we do is pray. 7 hours a day for 366 days, a year and a day. And about 4 months in, I go and I speak to the novice master, and I say, Father, I've said it all. I mean, when you're sitting there for 6 hours, 7 hours a day, after 4 months, you're like, that's it. I've said it, Father. I'm repeating myself. And he looked at me, and he's like in his 70s, Father Clement, now you can begin to pray. Now you can do butt prayer. And I was like, what is butt prayer? He says, now you take your butt, put it in the chapel. You say, Lord, my butt is here. I'm praying with my butt. Now, this is a deeply, deeply beautiful thing to say, actually. Because what happened is, for me, prayer has always been active. I got to do stuff. I got to say something. You see this in human relationships, right? If you go into a restaurant and you see two tables, in one table, they're talking like crazy. In the other table, the other couple, they're very quiet. They're just eating the meal. You know that the two who have been chatting, that's a young relationship. You can also tell that the two sitting there in silence, that's it. That's where they are. And what happens in Christian prayer is it enters a stage where you simply must sit. There's nothing to be said. He sits with you. You sit with him. You look at him. He looks at you. And most of life is like that. If you look at marriage, right? You know, if you look at marriage, my father just died last month. And my parents have been married 53 years. And one of the things I saw at the very end is, they didn't really talk. They said it all. I mean, like, but it was my, I had friends would come and go, your parents are still in love. And that was a great blessing. That to the day that my father died, my parents were still in love. And they said, how can you tell? Oh, it's just the way they walk. I'm like, what do you mean? Look at how they walk. And I'll be sitting there, how do my parents walk? And you can see there's just, wherever my father went, he knew, there was like, he knew where my mother was. And wherever my mother walked, she knew where my father was. There was just, they had become one flesh, as the scriptures reveal. And what happened is, they didn't really need to talk much. They were just with each other. Most of Christian prayer is like this. Now, what actually happens, though, is as Christian prayer matures in this way, as the relationship with God deepens, as any romance will be, there will be moments of darkness, right? And this is very striking, because the question now is, at the very beginning of any relationship, it always feels great to be with her. She's just so cool. Just watching Lion King, the movie is so much more beautiful. You know what I mean? You see, everything is just really, really cool. Fast forward 20 years. Not much. Not so. The pounds add up. You know, you got the kids are graduating, going to college. You've seen Lion King 222 times. And you can start quoting it to each other. It's kind of blah. Now, you can have date nights. I encourage date nights. But after a while, even the date nights, we go to the same place. We look at each other. We talk about the kids. We talk about the kids' boyfriends and girlfriends. It's all about the kids. And then after a while, there's nothing much. So there's darkness. There's darkness. There's a moment of darkness. Now, the Christian tradition will actually say, this is what Mother Teresa said, there are two reasons why you could feel what is called desolation. So consolation is the experience of delight in prayer. You know, it's really cool. God is tickling you. He's cool. He's fun. He's blessing you in all these ways. You love prayer. It's called consolation. But there will be moments, just like in any human relationship, where it will appear that God is not there. Now, this question arises. Why does that have to happen? Why does God have to withdraw the warm and fuzzy oxytocin-related feelings that you are experiencing in prayer? Because if we're not careful, the reason we pray is because of the warm and fuzzy feeling. See, and initially, in the immature Christian's life, you pray because it feels good. You don't pray because He is God. You pray because when you are praying, you feel good. So what He has to do is He has to slowly withdraw the warm and fuzzies so that you are praying not because of what He can do for you, but because of who He is. You see? And so what happens is it changes. Now, there are two reasons why you could experience this desolation, this absence of the apparent closeness of God, the darkness of God. And Mother Teresa explained it this way. Things could be dark because you are in a dark room. And this is analogy to sin. Because sin is alienation from this friendship. So if you want to draw closer to God, what actually has to happen is you have to actively seek out ways you have to seek His forgiveness and mercy constantly in order to remove whatever obstacles you are there. So if you're in a dark room, you have to switch on the light. And the way you do that is you approach Him in mercy and compassion, and you ask for His forgiveness. But the other reason, this is a beautiful image, he said, the other reason why you could be in darkness is because you are staring directly into the sun. Right? So there are two, when you stare directly into the sun, your proximity to light is so great, it so overwhelms your eyes that it appears you are in darkness, but it is actually your close proximity to light that is putting you in darkness. And the Christian tradition has always looked at this as the third step. So the first step is called active prayer. And the analogy there is you are planting a garden. And so what you have to do is you have to water that garden. You go to a pump, and you pump. And you have to do an enormous amount of work in order to be present to this friendship of the Beloved, the Divine Beloved. The second, the middle, is where you begin to simply give up. You sit with Him. The image, and these are images of Catholic Saint Teresa of Avila, the Carmelite master, she says, where the first is pumping, you're pumping a well, the second is there's a stream. And so what happens is there's a stream of water, so it's less you now, and it's more God, which is why God is calling you to be quiet. And this is called the prayer of quiet. You are quiet with Him, you are sitting with Him in a restaurant, eating, and it is that proximity to Him that is most important. The last is mystical prayer, and mystical prayer is compared to a thunderstorm. Right? So where you have the first, and this is a radical transformation. The prayer is so powerful, it changes the person from within and makes the person a saint. So it is, you can see this in a married life, right? You can see this in life. The longer two people spend with each other, they become more like the other. Do you understand? And in the same way, the longer you pray and the longer that you simply sit with God, He begins to change you. And so you can become, and this is the way that the Christian, you can become like Christ. See, the account here is that you can forget yourself. So you have exemplary Christians who appear to forget themselves for the sake of their neighbor. Again, the 20th century had Mother Teresa, who would simply forgot herself and spent a lifetime serving the poorest of the poor. She simply forgot herself. Now, what's really interesting is, you know, Mother Teresa won the Nobel Peace Prize. There is a story that at the end of the award ceremony, she forgot the prize under her chair, and she walked out. Now, how many of us, if you and I received the Nobel Prize in physiology or medicine, right, would forget the prize under the chair and simply walk out of the ceremony in Stockholm? Impossible. But and they asked her about that. They asked her about that. She said, this will only make sense if you are aware of her prayer life. The last 50 years of Mother Teresa's life was spent in darkness. So, and that God had called her to dark prayer, and called her to dark prayer precisely to empty herself out. And so she had the freedom. See, she was totally free to go anywhere and everywhere for the sake of the poorest of the poor, because of this emptiness in her heart. And the way she explained it is, she said, and I'm just going to paraphrase, when you don't have what you love the most in the world, there are no other loves. And so the Nobel Prize, you see, she longed for Christ and she loved Christ. And because of the darkness of her prayer, he seemed absent to her. It's called the dark night of the soul. And it's deeply purifying, it's deeply emptying, deeply transforming. You can also see it in St. Paul the Apostle. If you read several of his letters, it's very clear he goes through the dark night as well. And this is a description of the prayerful experience of darkness, where you pray in dark prayer. And this is deeply, deeply painful. It is a deeply painful prayer because it empties you out. It carves out a space within. When I entered the Dominican Order after residing position in London, I met with a group of Carmelite nuns there. They were, you know, and I met one of the sisters. She had graduated from Cambridge with a first-class degree and entered the monastery because she was looking for Christ. She'd been in the monastery for 35 years. And she asked me, she says, "Brother," so I was not a priest, she said, "Brother, what are you most scared about as you seek the Lord in consecrated life?" And I said, "Sister, I'm scared I will be lonely." And I think it's the deeply human need. And I'm hoping that my Dominican brothers will help fill that hole. I found this hole in my heart. And she snickered. As only a wise nun of 65 could say, she said, "Brother, that hole will get bigger." And I was like, "What?" And honestly, I was terrified. I said, "Wow." She says, "It will get bigger." She said, I said, "Why, sister? Why will it get bigger?" She said, "It will get bigger because God has to make it so big that he can fit inside. For the last 20 years, that is what makes it big." And it's painful. Imagine you take a heart that is this small, and now he must slowly, slowly. Now, he does it in different ways. In my vocation, it's another way. For those who are married, he does it with grumpy babies. You see? So notice what happens when your kid wakes up at 2 in the morning and cries, right? And you get up, your heart gets a little bit bigger because now you are living for another. You are living for the neighbor. And so this heart which you thought belongs to you now has to get bigger so it can embrace others. But it has to get, eventually, it has to get so big that God can fit inside. And that is something he does. You cannot do that. And he does that primarily through his grace working in your heart, through providence, and through prayer. And it empties you out. And so prayer, if you give it time, will become dark. It will become isolating. It will become painful because you are being challenged to love more. And love, if any of you have known the authentic love that we are all called to, love necessarily in a broken world embraces the cross. It doesn't do it wholeheartedly sometimes, but sometimes it is given. So we are stretched. And the idea here is that at this point, the transformation in this world can be such that if you pray long enough and you ask God to pray in you. Now remember, for Christians, it is not we who pray. It is God who prays in and through us, the Holy Spirit. And so giving up that space for the Holy Spirit is really tough because, so, you know, I remember thinking, I know how I'm going to be holy. And most Christians early on, they're convinced this is how we're holy. This is the way. And God is going to call you to surrender even that. He will surrender your presuppositions. He will ask you to surrender all that you have. And sometimes he will ask even for those who he loves the most, those who he calls closest to his heart, he will ask you to give up that which is most precious to you. Whether or not it is the paper in science, or the paper in cell, right, or that fellowship, he may ask you for that. And you can only deal with that if you are praying. And so this is why all those experiments don't work. As I was mentioning earlier, when you measure the outcomes of prayer, the assumption is that we're dealing with clinically verifiable outcomes. And for a Christian, the primary outcome of prayer is sanctity. It is holiness. It is the transformation of the person so that the person, you will not see that person, you will see Christ. You will see someone who has become a friend of Christ. That is now. And here, you know, my students will say, how do you know then? How can you verify prayer? And the invitation is, begin to pray. It is not only a first person experience, it can be a third person. You see, the saints are the proof of prayer. The fact that this person who was like this, take Saul, can become Paul, right? That transformation. Now, I was at a meeting in Cambridge, in the United Kingdom, some time ago with a group of Christian scientists, and we were talking about what is the sign of Christianity in a scientific world, okay? And a lot of people were saying, mindful, peace and serenity. I said, no way, because mindfulness can give you peace and serenity. There are two signs for the Christian. One is joy, and I'm talking about joy, which is the experience of spiritual delight, even in the face of suffering, right? So this is joy. This one you cannot fake. And the second is mercy, which is why Christ says, forgive your enemies, right? Mindfulness cannot make you forgive your enemies. And I've talked to people, and, you know, I've had people talk to me, and, you know, one person talked to me, and she had heard me preach about forgiveness, and she wanted to talk to me because she said, there's someone I cannot forgive. And I said, who is it? She said, my brother. I said, why can't you bring my... And she said, because he raped me 9 times when we were kids. But after hearing you preach, I have to forgive him. And I said, well, I want you to realize, first thing, the hardness of forgiving your brother who has sexually assaulted and raped you is natural. What God is calling you to is supernatural. So you must, you will try to do it on your own, and you will find an obstacle. You must ask him. This is what we call grace. You must ask him for that grace. Now, that grace can be given like that, and you can forgive. And there are people who I know have asked for a grace for forgiveness, and they have been able to forgive in a moment. It just changes their heart. But for others, it is a long process. And I say, okay, this is what we're going to do. You're going to say, God, I need you for to give me the grace so I can forgive all rapists. And then you're going to ask for, this might take 10 or 20 years. Then you're going to ask for the grace to forgive brothers who have raped their sister. Another 10 years. And maybe 30 years from now, you will ask for the grace to forgive my brother who raped me. Now, that process, you will go, well, why is it drawn out? Because it is a transformation. Now, people will ask, why is it that this person got that grace yesterday after one prayer, and this person, it will take a lifetime? And all we say is that in God's providence, each of us receives the grace that makes us saints as fast as possible. Some, it will be this grace. Some, it will be that grace. But graces are given because we are the pot. You know, He is the potter, and we're the clay, and He's making the clay. And some clay is a little bit, and so a little bit more water, a little bit more spin, a little bit more. And so what ends up happening is each one is an artwork in the making. But you see, all of this is important. Once you see how prayer is not just intercessory prayer, it is not just, I ask God for that step one. I know this is step one time. Lord, please, you know, step one. I just had my students have taken step one. Please, Lord, step... No. I really do want to be an orthopedic surgeon, so maybe a 260. You get to that point where you realize that is actually the kind of prayer that begins. The mature prayer begins, I love you. I know you love me. I know that you call me to joy. I know you will give me whatever you know will give me that joy, as well as what I will need to fulfill the mission that you have given me in this life to help others come to know you and to love you and to serve you. And I'm hoping that the step one will be part of that. But if it's not, it's not. Do you see what I mean? And so what happens is, as you are transformed and you realize that God knows better what you need than you, you stop praying in the way that is so specific. It becomes, just give me what it needs so I will love you more. I want to love you. I want to be your friend. I want to be a beloved. What does that mean? How am I called to be a lover of Christ? And now, at the end, at the close, because I know it's the end of time, I'm just going to invite you to, for those of you who are interested, begin now. And what I have to say is, do not give up. He loves you more than you could ever love Him. And the thing that I've discovered in my own life, prayer, is that He wants to know you. It is the only thing that you can give to Him. That is not Him. That's not His, per se, yourself. So you have to give yourself to Him, and you open up the world to Him. Now, I started that when I was at MIT, actually. I started to pray. It made me a priest. But the adventure of knowing that, of coming to know the triune God, has been the adventure of my life. And it's very cool. There are moments when He will where you will know His presence. He will just simply... you will be sitting down, and you will know He is sitting with you. Now, He doesn't sit beside you. For me, He sits behind me. I can feel His side. And when it's really tired, you're really tired. And sometimes I say, I want to see your face. He goes, no, not yet. Not yet. And I think the Christian dream, the Christian vision, the Christian hope, is that you see the Lord face to face. I mean, as a biologist, I wonder, what is the color of the Lord's eyes? And that's because, well, the incarnation, you know, that you talk to, look at His mother's eyes. Similar? Different? That's the kind of thing I think about. for that particular prayer, colleagues. Thank you very much.
Any questions?
Yes.
So regarding intercessory prayer, like praying for someone else, I'm not exactly clear on how this works, because I mean, I can understand, like, when you're praying for yourself, then, you know, that's a relationship between you and God. Whereas when you're praying for someone else,
have you ever asked your friend to help one of your friends?
But here's the thing. If your friend deserves to be helped, right, then I mean, it's like, why would God screw over someone else because you didn't pray for them?
Oh, it's not. So it's really interesting. This is a very interesting question. If God knows everything, and if God has willed everything from the beginning of time, why do you have to pray? And Thomas Aquinas, the great philosopher, the theocratic theologian, said, because in his providence he has already deemed that certain things he will give to you as response to prayer. So it's not like he doesn't know what he's, but in all of eternity he said, this grace I will give to that person because of his prayer. So you have to pray so that the grace that God has ordained from all time to be given to this person through your prayer will be given to that person. Because you go, why is that? Why does God, this is a philosophical question, why does God use doctors to heal? Why doesn't he just take the tumor away? Why are you guys studying to be healthcare professionals? If God can heal, why does he choose to heal through you? And the philosophical answer is because it manifests his power in a more profound way that he can invite you to share in that power. Right? So you and I can write a book, but you and I cannot make a book that can write itself. So actually giving to give a share of your power to something is actually a manifestation of the power that you have. And so when God calls one of you to be a physician, to be a surgeon, to heal this, when he could have done it himself, which is why people go, why are miracles rare? Because he chooses in a more profound way to work through creatures. Because in a way we don't understand, we don't appreciate, we think a miracle reveals more of his power. No, it's actually, philosophically, his power is revealed more when he works through instruments. And you know this if you ever try to teach an undergrad, calculus. So you can say, who is the better teacher? The one who can answer the question or the one who can get the student to answer the question? You'll see it's the one who can get the student to answer the question. So it's easy for me to answer the question. I can do that. But to get one of my students to do the calc, that's tough. So you see, when you realize that God, divine activity working through creatures is actually a more profound revelation of his power, which is counterintuitive, because we usually think miracles. No, when you go in there, when you guys go in there to heal, and he gives you that power, he shares in that healing power with you, and you get to heal, that shows you his power. So the same thing with intercessory prayer. You could heal that person, but he wants you to share in that healing work. Now, you could do it as a physician, or you could do it as an intercessor. And both are important. See? So this is the way that the philosophical tradition will respond to that. It was actually surprising to me because I think it's a much more sophisticated account that I ever got before I got my PhD. That God would choose this rather than that. I always assumed, like, you see, the assumption in a post-Enlightenment world is that you have a closed causal nexus of creaturely cause. So the idea is that God steps back and he lets us do all the stuff. And so it's really powerful when he gets in and he steps in and he does something. But, and I can't get into this, one of the things when you have an understanding of how you and I work, God is working through us. There is never a point where you can do anything on your own. So I'll end with this. It's called instrumental causality. So if I use this pen and I write, and I ask who wrote the note, you say, I wrote the note. No, the pen wrote the note and I wrote the note. We wrote the note together. Now it's 100% pen, 100% me. Both of us together, it's a call, co-causality, we're working together. When you go into a clinic and you heal someone, God is working. You are a pen in God's hand. So it's 100% you, which is why you have to do so well in your exams and do well in step ones and step twos, and you know, you just learn everything because it's all you. And if the pen is broken, I can't write. So if you don't learn what you have to learn, God will not be able to use you to heal. So, but when you heal, it's all you, but it's also all God. And when you have this deeply mysterious account of how divine action works from within, you can see it explained a lot more than this God who stands back, this deist God, who allows his creation to kind of like just unfold. It doesn't unfold, it's intimately associated. Thank you very much. God bless you.